Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Well, this is the last 2 days of our voter registration drive, because in most states the deadline is 1 month before the election, which would be Saturday. Tomorrow is the last business day before that deadline. So, if you haven't gotten any unregistered friends or acquaintances to register, please give it one last push here today and tomorrow. The forms are in the post office or at various campaign headquarters, and some of them are quite long, so you might want to help them fill them out on the spot so they don't forget. Get it mailed in. In a handful of states, the deadline is 15 days before the election, so you have 2 more weeks. But in most states, today and tomorrow is your last opportunity to get some citizens registered to vote who otherwise will not be able to. And, of course, the reason that's so important this fall is because of all the concerted efforts to block people from voting. Many people are going to be surprised on November 6th when they go to vote. If they don't, they're elderly, they don't have a picture ID, they're going to be turned away. So that needs to be countered, balanced by lots of new registrations. So, well, I guess what's on everyone's mind is the presidential debate last night. And, you know, like everyone else, I'm completely mystified why President Obama couldn't seem to think on his feet when Governor Romney so charmingly stated, "I've seen the count of 27 untruths spoken within 38 minutes of his talking time." And it also seems obvious that the president's campaign advisors must have given him stunningly bad advice. I mean, they get paid so much for being experts on electoral strategizing, and yet they sometimes do derail campaigns. You know, it really brought to mind the colossal blunder of the Democratic campaign advisors who were around Al Gore in 2000. When they started feeling the heat in late October, the pressure from the Green Party candidacy of Ralph Nader. And it's so obvious what the Liberal Party should do in a situation like that, because it had been done time after time, year after year, and country after country in Europe. So the model was quite public. The Liberal candidate, you know, just publicly announces that he or she has read the Green Platform and will adopt the following 3 or 4 or 5 policy positions from it. And bingo, the Liberal candidate in a system like ours would definitely pick up the Green votes, since none of the Greens wanted Bush to be elected. But instead, the Democratic campaign advisors around Gore convinced him to verbally give the back of his hand to the Green voters in his speeches day after day, scolding them and ordering them to get back into the Democratic Party. You know, "We have environmental platforms too. You should just get back in line here." And if you don't believe that, check the tapes of the evening news on the three big channels, because they would always open with any hit, you know, anything aggressive anyone said. So for several nights in a row, you'll see Gore, the opening feature on the nightly news, was Gore just scolding these Greens. And every time he did that, Nader's points would jump in the polls the next day in the close states. But they kept doing it. A very macho response. Well, how'd that work out? So, I mean, of course, Gore still, even with that bad advice he got, won the popular vote once all the votes were finally counted in Florida. But from that time on, I've been amazed at how wrong these very highly paid campaign experts can be. And last night, for instance, it seemed that President Obama's advisors had said, "Now, whatever you do, don't mention Romney's 47% comment in which he, you know, wrote off half the country in a very insulting way. Just keep repeating over and over again that his tax plan numbers don't add up, you know, Romney's plan." So my husband's guess is that Romney's debate advisors told him two main things. One was, just pretend you're chairing a meeting at Bain Capital. You own everything, you are in control, and this guy works for you. That's kind of what he radiated. That and the second bit of advice, you know, that Romney was doing very poorly with white working class women. So just radiate being such a kind, caring guy. Oh, yeah, we care about sick people, elderly people, poor people, you know, unlike his actually proposed policies. So I just want to remind you folks of a simple way to say this. If you know anyone who's undecided or was taken in by this great acting job last night, which was the opposite of his policies that Romney gave, Michael Frank in Harper's Magazine has an essay this month, October, saying it's really a choice between the maintenance crew and the wrecking crew. We all may wish in the progressive side of things that Obama were doing more, deeply addressing the real crises. But the wrecking crew is just going to turn back so much that has made this country work. And, of course, there were so many maddening things said last night. People are held back by government, and I don't know why Obama didn't say, people want to go to community college. That takes federal funding. You know, they want to go to state universities if they're not rich. That takes federal support. And to have federal support, we need to restore the revenue streams that were cut by Bush when he made the big tax cut for the upper brackets. It's pretty simple. Well, one last thing. I must confess, didn't hear the whole thing. I heard about 10 minutes in the beginning and 10 minutes in the end. I had to go out. Remarkably, when I came back, Obama was saying exactly the same thing. Now, Romney's numbers don't add up on this tax bill, tax cut. Anyway, but I understand from others that they both agreed on the Simpson-Bowles plan for Social Security. I think that was mentioned. I mean, if that's the case, I've been saying this for a while, but please, our time is running out. I just urge all of you to say in, you know, any call-ins to politicians on the radio or write to their headquarters, email them something, or your standing senator and congressperson, if they're not up for re-election in the Senate, just let them know that you want the Social Security fund to be fixed in the only democratic way. That's not the Simpson-Bowles way. Say, well, we have to do four things. Let's see. We have to make people work longer. We have to raise the Social Security tax a bit. And we have to cut the benefits a bit that people are receiving in old age. And we'll raise the cap on taxable income for the Social Security tax just a little bit. Instead of that combination of four things, only one thing has to be done to fix it, and that is to democratize the Social Security tax. We have a flat tax in this country for Social Security, but nobody's paying that flat tax on any earnings above $110,000. It's taking a big bite into all our incomes. We figure it's worth it because we get the benefits back in old age. But the high earners are not paying into it. They just stop at a certain level. So there should be no cap on taxable income for the Social Security flat tax. Everybody pays the same percentage. And please don't let politicians get away with saying it has something to do with the federal deficit. It has nothing to do with the federal debt and deficit because it has its own funding source. That funding source merely needs to be democratized. And really, they're making this bipartisan solution to sell everybody up the river unless there's a big uproar to say we want it solved simply by democratizing the Social Security tax. Okay, well, let's move into the interview, which actually has quite a bit to do with all this. My guest today is James Gustav Speth, known in environmental activist circles for several decades as Gus Speth. He was a Rhodes Scholar after earning a BA at Yale, and then he went back there and earned a law degree. He's been an environmental advisor to two presidents, President Carter, when he served as chairman of the U.S. Council on Environmental Quality, and later to President Clinton. He was a founder of the National Resources Defense Council and World Resources Institute. Gus Speth also served as administrator of the United Nations Development Program from 1993 to 1999. Oh dear, that was the bad old days of structural adjustment programs that were gutting everything in Africa, which was not the UN Development Program's fault at all. That was the IMF pushing those through, David Rockefeller. Anyway, Gus Speth has also been involved with the President's Task Force on Global Resources and Environment, the Western Hemisphere Dialogue on Environment and Development, and the National Commission on the Environment. Time magazine has called him the ultimate insider. Gus Speth was dean of Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies for 10 years, and he's now a professor at Vermont Law School. He's also a distinguished senior fellow at Demos and at the United Nations Foundation, and he currently serves on the boards of the National Resources Defense Council, New Economics Institute, New Economy Network, Center for a New American Dream, Climate Reality Project, and the Institute for Sustainable Communities. Last year, he was arrested in front of the White House. That was in August 2011, along with Bill McKibben and eventually more than 1,200 other people, in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. He's here with us today to discuss his new book, America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy, which first appeared in two issues of Orion magazine earlier this year. The new book, America the Possible, forms a trilogy with his two previous books, Red Sky at Morning in 2003 and The Bridge at the Edge of the World in 2008. Gus Speth, welcome to All Together Now.
How are you, Charlene? It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Well,
I appreciated very much your comments on the debate. I must say it was distressing.
Yes, and it was, and I want to ask you something in particular about that, because after I read America the Possible, or I should say I reread it, because I read it originally when it first came out in two parts in Orion last spring. I read it quite eagerly and was very impressed. But I was struck once again by the chasm between this type of book, written by environmental and or other activists, I've written a couple myself, that squarely name the problems and propose numerous pragmatic solutions and visionary systemic thinking, bringing together a lot of single-issue campaigns, the chasm between this type of book and the political speeches we routinely hear, the State of the Union addresses, the speeches at the Democratic and Republican conventions, and now, I must add, after last night, the talk we hear in the presidential debates. So I'd like to begin by asking you why you think that chasm is so stubbornly in place. But first, I want to orient the listeners by reading the list you present at the beginning of America the Possible of the problems our country faces. And these were taken from the studies done by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, 20 Industrialized Countries, a study that came out a couple years ago. And you list them very clearly. America now has the highest poverty rate, both generally and for children, the greatest inequality of incomes, the lowest government spending as a percentage of GDP on social programs for the disadvantaged. We have the lowest score on the United Nations Index of Material Well-Being of Children. We have the worst score on the United Nations Gender Inequality Index. Boy. Lowest on social mobility, the highest public and private expenditure on health care as a percentage of GDP, and yet the highest infant mortality, prevalence of mental health problems, obesity rate, percentage of people going without health care due to cost concerns, and consumption of antidepressants per capita, along with the shortest life expectancy at birth. We have the third lowest scores for student performance in math and middling scores in science and reading. We have the second highest high school dropout rate. We have the highest homicide rate, the largest prison population, both in absolute terms and per capita. We have the highest water consumption per capita and the second highest carbon dioxide emissions per capita. We have the lowest score on the Yale-World Economic Forum's Environmental Performance Index and the second largest ecological footprint per capita. We have the highest rate of failing to ratify international agreements. We're the third lowest. We have the third lowest spending rate on international development and humanitarian assistance as a percentage of GDP. We have the highest military spending in total and as a percentage of GDP. And we have the largest international arms sale. So really, folks, you know, when was the last time you heard that from the top? Now, Gus Speth, why do you think there's such a big, maddening skimming over the surface and dancing around the big problems by both major parties in Washington?
Well, our politics is fixated on this idea that we're exceptional, that we're the best. Politicians just can't afford right now to say much else, I'm afraid, the way things have developed. And that list, we are exceptional, I'm afraid. We've let ourselves sink to the very bottom across this whole front of issues. And when you have encompassing problems of the type you just listed, and many others, really, that aren't susceptible to international comparisons like that, you have to ask, why? And you have to dig deeply into why we have allowed these problems to come about and what's driving them. And I think, my answer is it's the system, stupid. We are living and working in a system of political economy that is delivering bad results routinely, environmentally, socially, economically, politically. And so the thrust of the book is really something that, is not in our immediate politics, but I predict will be before long. And that is that we need to complement, incremental reforms with a more than equal effort at systemic change. We need to drive fundamental change in our system of political economy until, in effect, we have a new one that routinely delivers good results for people and place and planet. And that's the fundamental change that we need to begin to work on. And fortunately, across our country, there are a lot of people working on these issues that
right.
I talk about in the book.
Yeah, there are a lot of good things happening at the grassroots. This whole month I'm featuring that, and I have been for months. This is about interconnections and people realizing that's how things really work. So we've had David Corton on, and we're having the co-director of Bioneers, Nina Simons, next week, and their annual conference the week after that is on these grassroots economic projects that are working. And then the last Thursday of this month, we're having the editor of Yes Magazine, Sarah Van Gelder, who has a great bird's eye view of all these new economics projects that are working. So I totally agree. It's just, again, I see this disconnect between the top and the grassroots, which is, it's just maddening. It's like you need to build up what can be done, and then you're also kind of swatting away at the stupidity and the blinders, which, of course, has a lot to do with the fact that money controls so much. And the higher you go, the more expensive the races are now, and they just cannot afford to affront anyone who might be giving big campaign contributions to the party. So that's definitely a big obstacle.
One thing I do in the book is spend a lot of time, indeed a whole part of the book, on the absolute necessity of sort of pro-democracy political reform, because if we don't straighten out our political system, incremental reform and deeper changes are not really going to be possible. And I think after this election is over, my hunch is that people are going to be so fed up that it will be possible for progressives and many others to come together behind a list of political reforms, and certainly atop that list has got to be reform of this whole issue of money in politics. And I think we need a two-pronged strategy there, one that really pushes hard on a constitutional amendment to undo the damage that Citizens United decision and other decisions have brought about. And secondly, we need a new piece of legislation which has been introduced into the Congress and has a lot of sponsors, not enough yet, but a good many, that would create a new system of public financing and small donor contributions.
Right.
So these are two imperatives. There are others that are surfacing, like the need to really secure the vote.
Right.
And as you were discussing earlier. About
who would have thunked it?
We would still have
to be fighting for voting rights at this 2012. I want to get into that later. I agree with what you just said. There does need to be systemic change. I'm wondering if after the election people will suddenly feel so discouraged that they'll wake up and get behind that, because I came across a line in an interview you did on your previous book. This is in 2008, an interview that was in Orion magazine. And, you know, it said, well, I hope there wouldn't be a real crisis, but it might take that, like the Depression, you know. So that was said in 2008, right before it happened, and the unemployment rates weren't quite everywhere. In some places they were at the Depression level, and it was a huge crisis. And people who'd never done anything risky financially lost their small businesses because suddenly people didn't have money to spend. Their customers disappeared because people were being put out of jobs. The credit froze. And the suffering across the nation was just horrendous. And yet that didn't trigger a big change in the system. The people who caused it looks like they barely broke a sweat at all over Dodd-Frank, or, you know, they're in there fighting all the time to not have more banking regulations put through in Washington. And so I thought it was so poignant to come across that. And one of the things I was really struck by when I read America the Possible last spring in the magazine form was when you said, we really need to be continuing the deep philosophical basis that FDR contributed in his proposal of the Four Freedoms speech in 1941, and then his second Bill of Rights, economic rights, in 1944. And then Eleanor Roosevelt continued a lot of that thinking. I'm sure she was part of framing it into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the United Nations in the mid-1950s. So I think this is so important to frame a deep philosophical vision of what America's about, because since the Reagan years, they've pretty much been able to just hijack the philosophy of the American vision and say it's about getting government off your backs, you know, and we're the Americans. The Democrats aren't even real Americans. So I think it's tremendously important what you hit on there. And I wonder if you could say something more to the listeners about these the Four Freedoms, and then the second Bill of Rights, and how that might be relevant to making a deep philosophical case for what needs to be done for America's people and land going into the future?
Well, I think the Four Freedoms, as you may recall, was freedom of speech and expression, and goodness knows that has dimensions that we often don't think about. You know, when I was really pleased to see Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Introduce the third-party candidates into the debate, which she did last night, and others excluded. But there, you know, that we need a broader commitment on the part of the media to deal with some of these harder issues. It was completely frustrating to me to look into the evening news on several networks and realize that they were reporting all these horrendous weather events, but adamantly refusing to link it to climate change.
In,
and it was very distressing. And
freedom
from want, goodness knows, we ought to have a commitment at least to return to the level of equality and social justice that we had in the 1970s, which we've moved so far away from as a result of the so-called Reagan Revolution and everything that's happened in the meanwhile. And I think Roosevelt had a grand vision for the country, which got deeper as he got older into his, presidency, which, of course, lasted quite a while.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that Eleanor Roosevelt was so instrumental in, it transcends what we normally think about as human rights and civil rights, and deals with the deep economic and educational and other needs.
Right.
So we need that kind of vision very badly. And you mentioned crises. I think the issue there is that we can expect more crises, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But what we have to develop is the capacity to use them in an effective way. And I think what happened in 2008 was enormously serious, and still continues to be. But we really weren't ready to mobilize to use the crisis in the way that we need to be. The one big good thing I think that came out of it was Occupy.
Right,
and that is, I hope, the beginnings of a stronger grassroots movement in the country, and a lot of the Occupy people and thinking was, you know, really aimed not so much at immediate political action, but was aimed at changing the way people thought about the world. And when I started writing my book 2 years ago, there was very little attention on the 1% or the 99% or the level of inequality in the country or the level of poverty or joblessness. And I think Occupy had a big effect in bringing those issues
Absolutely,
forward.
Especially with the phrase from Kali Lassen, you know, we are the 99%. We're going to have to pause here for the break, but I just want to say the reason I think FDR's these four freedoms are particularly smart right now is because the Republicans are always talking about, we're about freedom, we're all about freedom. And that's exactly the word he uses. You know, when he says freedom from want, he's really talking about structural violence, what we would call structural violence. You can't get an education. You can't get a job. You can't get vocational training. You're locked out of all those things, which is the case right now, what with the federal cuts, because the revenue stream's been destroyed. There are almost 500,000 people put out of the community college system in California compared to 2008 because the classes are all gone. They cannot get a college education. It's like a generation of college students. And so freedom from want, it's about structural violence, and freedom from fear, about actual physical violence. You know, we need to have a world order and peace. So I just think his use there of these are important freedoms is very relevant to the political discourse today. Anyway, we'll be back in a moment. Let's pause here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Gus Beth. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Gus Speth, about his new book, America the Possible, A Manifesto for a New Economy. So I think listeners to this program have a general sense of a lot of the contours of what the new community-based, more decentralized economy would look like. If we have time, we can get back to that. But we did hear a report from Stephanie Mills on the New Economics conference that you presented at in June. So we got a good overview of all those suggestions. And I wonder, instead, if we could focus here for a minute on the how this might happen. And in your book, you sketch out, as you say, a theory of change. So I wonder if you could talk about these seven factors.
Thank you. Yeah, I thank you very much for that invitation, because I think that is critical. And it is the source of hope. It's the reason I think we can be have a good bit of optimism that things are going to change for the better. The first thing that has to happen is that enough people have to be really fed up with the conditions that they find in the country. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, to see that the problem is systemic, that we have encompassing problems because of the underlying forces in our political economy, and we mm-hmm. need to change the system. Secondly, the crises are surely going to occur, and as I was saying earlier, we need to develop the capacity to take advantage, really, of them. Thirdly, we need to bring the progressives together. I'm afraid that the progressive communities in our country are still too siloed to take advantage of opportunities that will surely present themselves. So we need to build a unified progressive identity to institutionalize coordination across the many progressive communities, and to build an infrastructure that I'm afraid the right wing has successfully done and the progressives have it. So
right.
That's very important. We need a clear vision of what America could look like some decades from now, a positive vision of what the country could be if we got serious about deeper change. And we need to build this attractive future from the bottom up, as you have said. I think it's happening in our country with transition towns, with sustainable community development issues, with local banking and other things, with development of the co-op system and, move your money and other things. But this building, bringing the future into the present and the local communities is where the real action is right now in our country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We need a transformative leadership. I think many people thought they were getting that with President Obama and have been disappointed that he's more of a transactional leader than a transformative one.
Mm-hmm.
We need a new narrative. I have a great quote from Bill Moyers that America needs a different story. He says, the leaders and thinkers and activists who honestly tell that story and speak passionately of the moral and religious values it puts into play will be the first political generation since the New Deal to win power back for the people. And I think that new story is something we certainly need to work on. I mentioned earlier that we need to coalesce around an agenda of political reforms that do turn back this creeping corporatocracy and plutocracy that we see in our country and reassert real citizen sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
We need to come together and build a grassroots movement. It's part of the progressive fusion, but we need an upwelling of the type that was started with Occupy. I think we saw some of this in Madison and with the union activists there, and I think we saw some of it with the protests against the Keystone XL pipeline, which you mentioned earlier. We need a lot more of that, I think. And it's going to require a rebirth of marches and protests and demonstrations and even nonviolent civil disobedience in some cases. So I'm afraid that we have a lot to do. But if you go down that list of drivers of deeper change that I just went through, you can see in each area that some progress is being made. And in some areas, you know, it's bigger progress than others, like the development of local initiatives that you mentioned earlier. So I think there's reason for hope. And that's why I think there is an America of the possible out there. But, you know, there are things that are closing possibility down as we speak.
Yeah.
And we had the time is short.
Yeah, I want to talk to you for a minute about strategies. I can think of three main ones. But first, I have to mention this one spot in your book that made my heart stop, not in a pleasant way. It was where you were talking about these two bright students you had when you were still teaching at Yale, 2006, and they spent the year researching the whole progressive political community and concluded that progressives study from what they called strategic deficit disorder. So they say there's no unified progressive identity has been developed. And then they say, and this I think is stated without objection, nor have there been any concerted efforts to institutionalize coordination among the various progressive groups. Now, when I was invited to Germany in 1982, I was so impressed with the way the Green Party had brought together all these progressive groups. They brought together the feminists, the ecologists, the peace movement, new economy people, and they'd made a Green Party. So I came back to the United States and I thought, wow, that's what's needed here. Not the first person to have that thought. But so then with my old friend Fryjof Capra, I wrote most of the book, Green Politics, The Global Promise, and then I started getting phone calls, you need to start a party, a movement, and so in August, a few months after the book came out, August 1984, there was a founding convention with 62 people from different progressive single-issue organizations to come together and make this umbrella group. You know, the Green Party is the fusion of the eco-social analysis and vision. It's never just been ecological. And they're going on their 30th anniversary coming up in March of the Green Party being in the parliament in Germany. They're in a lot of power-sharing coalitions in Australia and many, many other countries. Very big force in the European Union parliament. And we have a lot of local officers here, mayors of even big cities like Richmond, California, an industrial city where the Green mayor, she's been reelected. So it's not that it's never been tried. And you're not the only one who somehow blanks it out. That's, I see this in print. But many political science professors have written technical articles about it in their professional journals and written books. And what we found, the problem I have reading this wonderful plan you have, is that our experience has been a little different. I think I've been more at the grassroots level. I certainly haven't been, you know, advisor to presidents as you have, which is so impressive. But we are about the same age. I see in your bio, I'm just a few years younger than you are. So we've lived through the same stretch of history, roughly. And what we found when we put up that big tent is that it really does not happen because all the groups are very nervous about going together and losing their particular identity, perhaps alienating their funding sources or their political connections who might not like some of these people in the coalition. There was just a lot of nervousness about among very good, well-intentioned people of linking up in that way. So I want to just move into my question about three possibilities. What I see that could be done now, and I'd be happy to hear if there are 10 possibilities, but one would be to make a big, as you say, organized, big, big movement, everybody coming together in a progressive umbrella, and this is what I assume, pressure the Democratic Party and change, as you say, the system in all kinds of different ways. But we've seen that they're very smug about saying, where are you people going to go? We don't have to listen to you. Progressive wing of the party, that's really nothing now, or even in the country. So that is one possibility. Another would be to mount a lot of campaigns for office that are sort of the equivalent of progressive Tea Party candidates. You know, really putting it out there, naming what we just said, putting proposals like yours out there, speaking of these deep values, and no matter what the DNC is saying. Now, that worked really well on the right because those Tea Party candidates were very well funded by some big money. And then the third option I can think of, again, is to use the fact that the Green Party has ballot access on almost every state. That's very hard to get. That's another way to pressure the system. So I just wonder what you think of the problem of making a big movement, even if it could be done. The Democrats kind of feel that on Election Day, you just have to vote with them no matter what. What about that problem?
Yeah, well, Charlene, I was, you know, really aware of your background with the Green Party as one of the people who started the whole Green political movement. And I agree very much with the three things that you have identified. Let me comment on them briefly. First, in terms of a big movement, we're seeing some really positive things happening, like Van Jones and his Rebuild the Dream movement, and others who are coalescing and around trying to get bigger things done in our country, and that does involve breaking down the two-party duopoly in the end, I think. I think you're absolutely right about that. And I talk about it in the book and recommend, I think, one of the big things that we could all fight for in terms of political reform would be fusion voting, which they have in New York.
Yeah.
They have in Vermont here. And, when you have fusion voting, there's no risk. There doesn't have to be a risk that a third-party movement would be, as they say, a spoiler, or you would be throwing your vote away.
Can you explain that to the listeners? Explain to the listeners how a fusion candidate works?
Yeah, well, fusion voting, which works well in New York and works well here in Vermont, a third party can select as its candidate a candidate from one of the major parties or any party, other party that it wants to. And when the two parties saw this coming, they moved in almost all states to outlaw it. But we need a movement to push it back, because what it means is that a third party can bargain with the other parties
right.
for its support. And it's done so well in Europe because they have totally different systems of selecting representatives.
Most countries, but not all of them. Some of them have our winner-take-all, but most of them have, yes, proportional representation.
Proportional representation of some form, and that gives an automatic role. But what we could do would move to this fusion voting. The second thing is the Tea Party, I think, shows that you can move from, protest to movement to power quickly. And we need to use that model. And as I say in the book, it's very important for progressives to coalesce and begin to field candidates. In my environmental area, we have been so neglectful of electoral politics over the decades now. And
right.
That needs to change.
They had a unified organization behind them. Actually, there were three, and I think they felt so supported. They weren't just lone cowboys saying, I'm not going to follow what Boehner says to do when I get in Congress. I'm going to do this, this, and this. And, they got more media attention in 9 months than the Greens have gotten in 9 years. So
yeah,
they were part of a big unified group.
We need, we also need, I think, to, one thing that's happened in parallel with the rise of inequality and the stagnation of wages and the lack of real commitment on the social front has been the decline of the unions in our country. And we need to tilt one of our agendas should be to tilt the playing field back towards unionization and collective bargaining and the right to organize and in And at the same time, to build a powerful bridge between, say, the environmental community and the labor community, which
right.
is started that. It started to build that bridge when, you know, in the 70s with the oil, chemical, and atomic workers cooperating with the with the environmentalists. But it's gotten off track now, I think.
Yeah.
We need to bring it back.
Yeah. Actually, we're out of time, but I'm so interested in hearing what you said about there was an effort to get fusion voting, and it got beaten back by the big parties, so it was not able to go into effect except in two states. So that's something that should be high on our list to fix, to reverse, to get the fusion voting. I want to thank you so much, Gus Beth, for coming on to the program.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I really admire what you're doing.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's very mutual. All right, let's amble over to the Arts Corner for our poem this week. I think it's best to keep up our spirits during this electoral season with a bit of Walt Whitman. This is from Section 16 in Leaves of Grass, which was first published in 1855. I am of old and young, of the foolish as much as the wise, regardless of others, ever regardful of others, maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man, stuffed with the stuff that is coarse and stuffed with the stuff that is fine. One of the great nations, the nation of many nations, the smallest the same and the largest the same. A southerner, soon as a northerner, a planter, nonchalant and hospitable, a Yankee bound my own way, ready for trade, my joints, the limberest joints on earth, and the sternest joints on earth, a Kentuckian walking the vale of the Elkhorn in my deerskin leggings, a boatman over the lakes or bays or along coasts, a Hoosier, a Badger, a Buckeye, a Louisianan or Georgian, a Pokeezy from sandhills and pines, at home on Canadian snowshoes or up in the bush, or with fishermen off Newfoundland, at home in the fleet of ice boats, sailing with the rest and tacking, at home on the hills of Vermont or in the woods of Maine or the Texan ranch, comrade of Californians, comrade of free Northwesterners, loving their big proportions. Comrade of raftsmen and coalmen, comrade of all who shake hands and welcome to drink and meet. A learner with the simplest, a teacher of the thoughtfulest, a novice beginning experient of myriads of seasons. Of every hue and trade and rank, of every caste and religion, not merely of the New World, but of Africa, Europe, or Asia, a wandering savage, a farmer, a mechanic, or artist, a gentleman, sailor, lover, or Quaker, a prisoner, fancy man, rowdy, lawyer, physician, or priest. I resist anything better than my own diversity, and breathe the air and leave plenty after me, and am not stuck up and am in my place. The moth and the fish eggs are in their place. The suns I see and the suns I cannot see are in their place. The palpable is in its place, and the impalpable is in its place. Our song today goes out to President Obama regarding the next two debates. This is the great Ella Fitzgerald singing a song composed by Duke Ellington in 1931. Mr. President, with all due respect, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Here's Ella.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I. It don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is sing. Do I, 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 do I. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you got. Oh, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I? It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I? Don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is sing. Do I? It makes a difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you got.
Fitzgerald singing It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Nina Simons, co-director of Bioneers. Till next time, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now,